Monkey Bicycle Podcast.
This is an excerpt from One Year After the Death of Leonardo by Joe Sullivan for issue 6 of Monkey Bicycle. The moment my great uncle passed away, I was asleep in bed. I have no memory of any dreams that night. He never came to me, he never said anything. He just went. His ghost was never present at my bedside for a last goodbye before the great beyond. When I left the hospital on that night of his death, I had no real idea it would be the last time I'd see him alive. The nurses had sedated him to make him comfortable. He was sleeping when I left. My mother came to me as I lumbered down the living room stairs in my underwear the morning after. She looked very tired and sympathetic. She said simply, "Luke," Luann called, "Leo died last night." "What time?" I asked. "I was there." "Around 3, she said. "When's the funeral?" "Friday morning. The wake's on Thursday night." I nodded, looked at her briefly in silence, shrugged, and headed for the shower. This news was devastating to me. But I didn't want my mother to see that, so I didn't discuss it. She probably knew how I felt anyway. I had always loved Leonardo the best of any of my relatives because he was the most exciting. Even if he wasn't talking, he commanded attention. He had been a musician all his life, learning violin as a child, then playing upright and electric bass, then singing. He drove a Cadillac and wore fur coats and played gigs in country clubs run by the mob. In any social situation, he was in charge. He had the largest laugh at any table of people, and he used good-natured teasing to win people over to his side. He was opinionated and said exactly what he felt. He drank a lot, he ate good food, he traveled the world, he enjoyed life. The water blasted down on my face from the showerhead, and I thought about how I was going to ask for time off from work. I had only been on the job for a little over a week. I was sure they'd understand. Still, I felt tentative about broaching it with my boss. I was working in the marketing department of a large investment bank in downtown Boston. I had graduated from college a month before, and I already knew that I didn't want to be working there. No one had gotten around to training me yet either. Each day, I counted the days I'd been there. People would come to me in my cubicle and ask, "So when did you start?" I would answer with the exact number of days. As if this added up to some sentence that I was serving. I was extremely uncomfortable. The people in my office spoke a certain lingo, and I didn't like the sound of it. It was evil to me, like a scheme was being enacted. I didn't know how to combat it or snap them out of it. I felt defenseless. They wanted me to become someone else for 8 hours a day. In the morning, if someone asked how I was doing, I was supposed to answer with "great" or "good," instead of "tired" or "lousy." I wasn't supposed to be truthful or forthcoming. I couldn't see myself trying to do that for long. It was dishonest. I wanted to leave as soon as possible for some place where the people spoke honestly. But I needed the money to pay off college loans. And now, to add to this reality, my great uncle, my last great living male relative, was dead, and I had to somehow explain I couldn't come in on Friday. When I got into work and spoke to my boss, I expected her to answer with, "Oh, you just want to take a long weekend." But she didn't. I was allowed to go to my uncle's funeral. But my boss told everyone in the office that my uncle had died. I came in a day after talking to her, only a week into the job, and the office receptionist, who I barely knew, said, "Luke, I'm sorry to hear about your uncle." Surprised, I looked at her and said, "Oh, thank you." Immediately, I went to my boss and asked her if she told the receptionist my uncle had died. She said she had. I left her office feeling violated. I didn't like virtual strangers knowing my business. It only added to my discomfort. After that, I vowed to say very little to anyone. I had known Leonardo was sick for a few months. When I saw him during Christmas, he sat hunched over on the edge of the recliner in my mother's living room and didn't say much. My Aunt Luann said he had a cold that he couldn't get over. He was very thin, and his lidded brown eyes watered as he wiped his nose. I didn't really get to talk to him or Luann because they left so quickly that day. For the 3 weeks after my college graduation, I visited Leo in the hospital every other day. He had a large, brightly lit room with a sleeper sofa for Luann. They'd stuck tubes in him for fluids and pain relief, I assumed. Luann was always by his side, and usually one of his daughters was there too, more often than not his daughter Anna, my second cousin. During one of my visits, Anna asked me, "Luke, how's the new job?" "I don't know yet," I said. A few days later, she asked again, "How's the job so far?" "I don't know," I said. "He's being very diplomatic about this job," she said to my aunt. I didn't say anything, but I hated the job. I didn't want to sound negative or angry, so I kept quiet. A few days before Leo died, he sat up a little bit in his bed. His daughter Anna was talking about taking a 6 a.m. train from Worcester to Boston each day and doing work on her laptop on the way. Leonardo looked at me and said, "That's you. That's going to be you. You just started this crap." Then he smiled and let out what was left of his cackle. He was teasing me, as he always had. I shook my head and said, "I don't think so. That's not me." Then I smiled half-heartedly and sat there thinking about how I wasn't going to fall into that life in an office, silent and computerized, endless days of repetition, boredom, complacency, loss of spirit. I tried not to worry. It was only going to be for a few months, I told myself, until I found something better. Later, during that same visit, while a nurse came to check Leo's temperature, Anna asked me, "How old was your dad when he passed away?" 40, I said. "Your dad's death was a real tragedy," she continued. "He was so young, and three kids, too." I just nodded. I didn't really know what to say. I wasn't offended, but I didn't want to talk about it, even though it seemed to be something Anna and I were about to have in common. I felt myself shrinking into my chair as she looked right at me, searching for a response. The women did just about all the talking during my visits. Leo couldn't talk much. Even though he had been a lounge singer since his 20s, he spoke only in a rasp now. Though no one talked about it, he was dying from cirrhosis. He'd always been a big drinker. Whenever I saw him, at family functions or on brief visits, he drank scotch. Leonardo and my father had both been big drinkers. They drank and hung out together more than anyone else in my family, and I associated them very closely with each other. Every Sunday, Leo showed up at our house and they drank with Luann, while my mother looked on, not drinking, not saying too much. My father had passed away when I was 10 from liver cancer. After my father's death, I felt isolated from other people, because other people didn't have dead parents, had no idea what it was like, and it was impossible to explain. Now Leo, the last great male figure from my youth, was gone too. With his passing, a chapter of my life closed. I felt that I'd been left alone to figure things out for myself. At Leo's wake and funeral, I can remember his face looked sunken as he lay there in the coffin. He didn't have his dentures in. My brother and I stood with our arms crossed at the rear of the funeral parlor during the wake. Aside from that, I don't remember it very well. Maybe I tuned most of it out. But later, at the reception in the large Italian men's club downtown, I remember they served meatballs and ziti with salad after Leo was buried. It would have been a typical Sunday family dinner for him had he been there. I sat down at a table with one of his old bandmates, Ahmed. I hadn't seen him since I was a little kid, but I knew who he was immediately. He was a Lebanese trumpet player with slicked back gray hair and blue eyes that sparkled through square-lensed glasses. Even though his friend had just died, he was completely and utterly positive. His face beamed. He was a star we orbited to gain warmth. I was eating meatballs when he spoke to me. With bright eyes, he said, "Isn't this food beautiful? They do a wonderful job here." "They do," I said. "They put a lot of garlic in these. I love it." Ahmed started telling a couple of people I didn't know about the first time, 50 years earlier, he and Leo got noticed as musicians. They were 24 and had been playing clubs around Worcester for a couple of years when Ahmed suggested that Leo take over the vocals for their group. It was difficult to sing and play bass in unison, but Leo did. Within a couple of months, their group was the hottest thing in Worcester. They got good reviews in the papers and the crowds grew. Leo was being billed as an Italian crooner like Sinatra. "We thought it would only be a matter of time before we hit the road for a national tour," Ahmed told us. "We figured there might be big things on the horizon." "So did you tour?" I interrupted. "We did. Eventually we hit the road. I'll tell you, we had fun. We played all over, mostly as openers. When we got back, we made a record," Ahmed continued. "We were on the local radio for a little while. After that, we just kept gigging, man. We loved to play."
"Did you guys all play music full-time at that point?" I asked.
"No, no, we all kept our day jobs. But we played as much as we could. Leonardo loved to play. He loved to command a room."
"When you guys were getting noticed a little bit, did it ever go to your heads?" I asked.
"Maybe a little bit," Ahmed answered, still upbeat. "We were excited for the attention, but we kept our senses. My father and your great-grandfather would have kicked our butts if they saw us living like musicians. They thought it was a lazy, immoral profession with all the late nights and women. But man, we loved to play."
I smiled as he said those last few words.
A little while later, my second cousin Anna came up to me again. I was standing near the front door with my mother getting ready to leave. Anna asked me, "So do you think you'll stick around here?"
"I don't know," I said.
"I'm interested to hear what happens to you," she said, smiling but sad. I smiled at Anna and gave her a hug. We'd bonded during my visits to the hospital. Then it was time to clear out of the Italian men's hall and head home. Things didn't feel that different to me. Leo's death was still sinking in. About a month later, I moved out of my mother's house in the suburbs into an apartment in East Somerville, a short distance from my job in downtown Boston. I felt really happy about it at the time. My studio apartment was nothing special, but it was cheap and clean. Two first-time landlords from Ireland owned it and had just refinished all the walls, floors, and cabinets. During my first week there, I met the two men who shared the only other apartment on my floor. They introduced themselves to me as Dr. B and Mr. C. I never found out what those initials stood for. They lived in the very large apartment across the hall from me in my new building. Dr. B had dual PhDs in philosophy and poli-sci. Mr. C had a master's degree in psychology with a concentration on emotional disorders. Mr. C didn't teach. He ran an office at one of Cambridge's smaller private colleges, Leslie College, where B was a professor. The two of them were indistinguishable in the way they behaved, which was formal most of the time. But their appearances were very different. Dr. B was tall and round. He was bald and had a goatee that grew far below his chin. He wore glasses with tiny circular lenses that made him look German or Eastern European. He often wore large brown beads and a tight choker around his neck. Occasionally he smoked marijuana. Very often he drank tea. He taught classes in social thought and Indonesian politics. Many of his colleagues felt he was brilliant, but not as brilliant as he thought himself. To say that he bragged about himself was true. To say that he exaggerated the truth was also true. Say that he bragged and exaggerated in order to appear brilliant might also be true. I tried to ignore him when he got like that. I thought he had a little bit of a lying problem. Mr. C was also tall but thin. He had hair that went in every direction and he spoke dramatically with a lisp. He never ate and had a very pale complexion. Sometimes he would go on week-long fasts, subsisting only on seaweed extract, and then cleansing his colon afterward. He was obsessed with eating correctly and purifying his body. It made him cranky, and at times, I'd see him stomping around the apartment, silent and barefoot and deliberate. There was no doubt in my mind he envied Dr. B. It was the brilliance, real or imagined, that got him. Mr. C wanted Dr. B's brilliance. He wanted to catch it in a jar like fireflies in the summer. Then he would devour it. I could see that clearly. In the meantime, he ran the office at the college that dealt with students' personal problems. It was all very secret and unmentionable. I attempted to ask him about his work a couple of times, but he'd just shift the focus back to me. The The thing that I found odd about these two men, after spending time with them for a couple of nights and learning of all their credentials and idiosyncrasies, was that they chose to share an apartment. It seemed to me that either of them should have been able to afford a place of his own. I asked them about it one night. Dr. B said, "Well, you see, we're both young. I'm only 32. He's 31. C nodded. B continued, "It's lonely to live alone at this age when you're not married. All of our friends are married. Besides, we get along fine, and we've lived together for quite a while. I dare say it's continued by habit." C nodded again. "But couldn't you afford to buy a house on a professor's salary?" I asked. "Well, maybe," B answered. "But you see, I have debts to pay. And besides, I'm too lazy to look for a house right now. We humans are a very lazy species." I laughed slightly. "What about you?" I asked C. "I don't believe in owning anything," he answered very seriously. That same first week in my new building, I was coming in from a night spent reading at the local coffee shop. It was about 10:30. Dr. B and Mr. C were across the hall raving about a microdisc C said he had found during his trip to a conference at one of Argentina's universities in March. I heard B say, "You must be joking. This is a floppy disk for an outdated Macintosh." But C believed the disk contained top-secret information about the U.S. government's war plans in the Middle East, and he wanted Dr. B to use his poli-sci contacts to help him get the disk read and the information deciphered. At least that's what I could gather from a couple of minutes in front of their door. Later, I learned that both B and C were prone to making all sorts of outlandish claims. I unlocked my own door to my small Salvation Army second-hand furnished room, and I went inside. There was a message waiting for me. Before I could check it, though, Dr. B knocked on the door. "Do you have any butter?" "No, but I have some marijuana." Dr. B entered. I packed a bowl, and we began to smoke it. Already bleary-eyed, I said to him, "What the hell were you guys talking about over there?" B's eyes got real big, and he said, "Oh, were you listening, Luke? Did you hear us? C's talking out of his ass," he giggled. He started laughing, and I couldn't make out what he said. He was spazzing out a little bit, struggling to keep his composure. Then he got up and went across the room to my refrigerator. On top was a box of cupcakes, chocolate kind with cream filling. He grabbed two and ate them. Then I said, "Why do you guys even care about this political bullshit? It's not like you can do anything about it." Dr. B didn't have an answer. He just looked at me briefly, and I could see he was drifting off into some kind of space out. The pot was probably stronger than he was used to. He emerged from his trance and said, "Well, I gotta go cook this chicken." He sighed and left. He baffled me. I listened to my phone message. It was from a credit card company trying to sell me on the new greatest thing. About a month after first meeting B and C, I found myself at the One Dive Bar in Cambridge's Central Square. I was alone with the idealist bartender who really didn't say too much. I suspected he was an idealist, though, maybe even a cynic. He was young, intelligent, around my age, and a bartender. He was probably also an aspiring creative type. I noticed he had a tattoo of a sun emanating rays on the inside of his wrist. That was a sign for me. He wouldn't have wanted to ever find himself strapped to a chair in an office because he had other plans, and he followed them, even if it meant bartending for the alcoholics who caused him to never want to drink. I didn't really know him, but I thought I might know his type. Two women came in, and one of them was my age. I didn't think I'd meet very many women my age at the dive bar. Maybe the artist types with bright red spiky hair, maybe to go along with tattoos and a nose, lip, or cheek ring. Usually it was old hag alcoholics in this place. But this girl looked fairly normal. She was small and thin with light brown, almost yellow eyes, a color I'd never seen before, and long brown curly hair that fell onto a white sweater. Below that, her jeans were slightly ripped and looked like they had splotches of paint on them. She was a Brazilian, I think. I found out later from the bartender she was a hairdresser. She was waiting to be noticed, but the bartender came over to me first and said, You want another? I said, sure. Brazilian hairdresser said, oh, sure, you serve the yuppie, but you ignore the poor girls from Somerville. I got angry. I wasn't wearing a sweater around my neck summering in Newport, Rhode Island. I wasn't flaunting anything like the people I worked with might. I was in old jeans and a plain white t-shirt drinking Bud Draft like everyone else in the place. She was obnoxious, I thought. I'm not a yuppie, I said. You look like a yuppie, she shot back. Well, I'm not. I don't drive a fancy car and I don't make a lot of money. I don't even really care about money. She ignored me and ordered a gin and tonic. Her friend ordered a rum and coke. I got up and left, wondering what had made her see me as a yuppie. When I got home, I heard Dr. B and Mr. C arguing loudly about Israel and the Palestinians. They were always arguing about things that were way beyond them, I thought. It seemed like they just talked to hear how intelligent-sounding they could be. It was an ego thing. I didn't like their talks. I didn't like debate for the fun of it because of the ego thing. It seemed useless to try to crush an opponent with rhetoric, because when it was over, the words were gone like the whole thing had never happened and somebody's feelings were usually hurt. There was nothing productive there. I went into my apartment, smoked some pot, and refused to turn on the television. I ate pasta, drank a beer, and thought about who I'd like to call. No one. There was no one I could really communicate with tonight. I wanted to tell someone I was feeling down. I wanted to tell someone everything about myself. I'd been saving up. I did that a lot, I guess. I didn't like talking unless there was someone really listening. Maybe I needed therapy. I decided to do some reading and go to bed, but those guys across the hall were still going at it. They were yelling so loudly I could hear everything. My neighbors, Dr. B and C, embraced things that were called smart, but which really didn't make any sense. I realized that what they talked about had no application in the everyday world. They read the big papers like the Washington Post or the New York Times, and they rehashed what they read and debated about it. They could tell you just about anything that was going on in the world of science or international politics, but when it came to interacting with each other, or interacting with people in general, they had a very hard time. They were nerds, basically, who thought they weren't. I was just about to pass into sleep when I heard them at it again. They were talking about a global conspiracy run by the U.S. and the British. They kept trying to figure out or talk about things they knew nothing about, things they would never be open to, because they never really let go and gave themselves over to it. They always had themselves first in their view of all things, and their egos skewed it all. There was nothing pure about it anymore. It was a few facts, a lot of ego. A lot of ivory towers and black turtlenecks and tweed blazers, all clustered together on some hill in academia. I didn't really understand any of it, but I could relate a little. Lately, I had been having a hard time myself, interacting with the real world and the people around me. But for them, debating current events or historical facts was their form of escape. A week after first tasting the Brazilian woman's attitude, I asked the bartender about her. I was curious. I learned from him that the hairdresser's name was Hilda. She lived with her sister, but her sister was never around. They lived in a huge loft above a pottery studio on Broadway in East Somerville. The bartender told me Hilda would stop in periodically for a drink, maybe once every couple of weeks. He said she could be very loud, but at times she was sullen. Typically, she drank rum and cokes. She didn't tell him much about her personal life, only stories about people she met at work, the salon. Usually, she complained. She didn't view people in a positive light. But it sounded to me more like she just hated her job, and that hate was bleeding into other areas. The same thing had happened to me at my job, even though I'd only been at it a short time. When Hilda strode into the bar that night a week after we'd first met, she was already drunk. I could tell because her eyes were half shut. She looked at me and said with a smirk, "Oh, you again." She was belligerent. The bartender didn't care. He fed her two quick rum and cokes. I saw that she was talking with him a bit, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. I said goodnight to Hilda after my last beer. She followed me to the door. I looked at her with my eyebrows raised, and she slurred,
Do you have pot?
I nodded. Can I have some?
Yeah, do you want to buy some?
No, not really. I just want to smoke.
Well, it's at home.
Where do you live?
About 8 blocks away.
That's too far, she said.
Well, what do you want me to do? I asked.
Go get some pot and bring it back here, she said. We'll smoke it here.
I don't really feel like smoking.
Fine, you don't have to. I'll smoke it and you can watch.
I was shocked by her presumption. I should have said I didn't have pot in the first place. Now I knew she'd press me for it until it became unbearable. I could have just gone home and not come back, but I knew I'd see her there again. When I got back to my apartment, Mr. C was in the hallway.
I'm locked out, he said.
Why don't you call the landlord to let you in, I said.
It's too late, he said. Would you mind if I hung out with you for a while, like just until Dr. B arrives?
Yeah, sure, whatever, I said, but I'm heading back out.
That's fine.
Mr. C followed me back to the bar and we went inside. Hilda's face brightened when she saw us. She was drinking water now, but her eyes were still half shut. Mr. C waved to her.
You know her? I asked.
Yes, we met a few months ago, he said. She was at a dinner thrown by the chair of the fine arts department.
Why, is she a student?
No, Mr. C said. Her work was on display, though, in the university's gallery.
Her work?
Her paintings and sculpture.
Just then, Hilda came over and smiled and said hello to Mr. C.
You have the weed, she said to me.
I nodded and patted my pocket.
She grabbed her coat and we went outside, a few blocks south of the bar to a dark ball field near a school.
Mr. C and Hilda were talking now, and he was motioning constantly with his hands and being generally lispy and flamboyant.
She was laughing a lot, more than I thought was necessary. I was in a serious mood and on the lookout for cops.
I brought out the pot and we smoked from a small bat-shaped pipe while walking along the edges of the park. Gradually, Mr. C and Hilda's conversation was dying down as they both grew more stoned. We found a bench and all sat down and remained silent for a good while. I could hear very intensely the cars going by, and I smelled the cold grass very strongly. My teeth felt strange and cold, and I moved my tongue along them. I kept blinking and putting my hand to my head. Mr. C and Hilda kept quiet, and I have no idea what they were doing while I sat there feeling my teeth, listening to cars, and smelling cold grass. I was completely consumed by my own sensations and the multitudes of thoughts born from them. I was thinking of a scene from a movie when Hilda said to me, "I have to go. Thank you for the pot." And, "Nice to see you again," to Mr. C. She disappeared swiftly, and we made our way back to my building. Dr. B was home, and Mr. C got in all right.